for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last night, President Obama devoted the majority of his first State of the Union address to the economy, putting people back to work and bringing down the deficit. He also called on Republicans to work with him in addressing the nation's problems and said he will not accept second place for the United States of America. Joining me in the studio to talk about last night's speech, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, the Washington Examiner's Byron York, and E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post. I'm sure many of you have your own thoughts, your own reactions to the president's first State of the Union address. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also send us a tweet. You can send us a message through Facebook. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
E.J. Dionne, I'm going to start with you. Your reaction to the speech overall?
I think it was a good speech because I think Obama began to dig Democrats out of the hole they've been in that was dug for them by the voters of Massachusetts and some of their own mistakes. Going into the speech, I think the most striking thing in politics is that Democrats had lost the messaging war on the two biggest issues before the country, two biggest achievements or trying to be achievements, the stimulus bill and the health care bill. He did a number of things. First, I think he calmed Democrats down. Democrats were starting to worry, has Obama lost his magic? They were wondering, can he, succeed after all? I think he showed that he is still very good at this. And that was actually quite important, not only here in Washington, but among his supporters in the country. Second, I thought it was important that he made a very strong statement on health care. He sounded a very uncertain trumpet after the Massachusetts election. It wasn't clear what he wanted Congress to do. He made pretty clear he wants them to stick with a big bill and pass it. Third, he basically signaled Democrats are now going to make Republicans pay a price for obstruction. If the Village Voice had a great headline after the Massachusetts race, Republicans claim 41-59 Senate majority. And I think that he said, all right, you guys think 41 votes gives you a lot of power. What are you going to do with it? And so I think finally there'll be more of a public debate about the Republicans. And lastly, he didn't choose his more eloquent mode. He was a more likable person. He was somewhat self-deprecating. There were some funny moments in the speech. And he's got to transfer some of his likability to his program. His likability quotient is higher than support for his policies in the polls. And I think he tried to make a little bit of a transfer last night.
E.J. Dionne at the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, your reaction.
I thought this was Barack Obama trying to take back his presidency. And I was very struck by his warning to Republicans and also to Democrats. He basically said to Republicans, if you think leadership requires, a 60-vote majority, forget it, you're wrong. And he's told Democrats very pointedly, you've got to stiffen your political spines. Don't run for the hills, he said. And I thought that that was a very interesting message from the president to his own party. I agree with EJ. He had been a little shaky on health care after the Massachusetts victory. So I think he was able, in a way, to take a big step back and to weave together the very complicated strands of his presidency into a narrative around the economy that is a little bit easier for the American people to understand and also to digest at this point, because we know Americans are angry about the economy. He made very clear, I got that message. Jobs is my number one focus this year. And I do think he came across as likable, a little self-deprecating. We heard him say that the bank bailout was about as popular as a root canal. He got a few laughs. So this was Barack Obama, the president, trying to get back the mojo of Barack Obama, the candidate.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, The New York Times. Byron York, your reaction.
I thought it was a little strained. I thought this was the speech in which the president was supposed to execute the grand pivot from healthcare, which he and his party had spent an enormous amount of time working on, even though it's not the public's top priority, to jobs in the economy, which is, in fact, the president's top priority. But the grand pivot was supposed to occur after winning a victory on healthcare, which he has not done. So he's spent the biggest part of the speech and the first part of the speech on the economy, but he gets to health care, and I agree with EJ. I don't think he gave an inch on health care. I think he basically said, I've got all these requirements, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I believe there were, and if you can come up with a bill that does them better, tell me. But otherwise, no. And the only error that he admitted, I think, was he said that he took his share of blame for not explaining the bill more clearly the American people. So I think that this pivot was only partially done because he still has this health care fight, and he seems to be encouraging Democrats to keep it up when many of them seem to want to run away from it. So I think that was a problem that sort of weighed down the entire speech.
Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. EJ, is the health care bill dead?
I don't think it is. First of all, I agree with Byron that he had hoped this speech would allow him to do a clean pivot, but circumstances simply didn't allow him to do that. And I thought he did reasonably well with what he had to work with because he couldn't make the clean pivot until health care is passed. I think there is growing sentiment in both houses to do what some have called the sidecar solution, which is that the Senate will negotiate some changes in the bill, which they can put into what's called a reconciliation bill that can get through the Senate on a majority vote and not this artificial 60 votes. The Senate sends that back to the House, and the House passes both bills. There's immense mistrust right now between House Democrats and Senate Democrats, and the House just will not pass the Senate bill on a promise that some of the things they don't like, such as the Cadillac tax, the tax on so-called Cadillac health plans, will be fixed. This is not easy to do, but I think it's possible. Nancy Pelosi had some reporters and columnists in yesterday, and it was very interesting. Whenever she was about to say reconciliation, she stopped herself and said, no, what I'm talking about is majority rule. And I have been struck that bills that Republicans were happy to pass the Bush tax cuts on reconciliation, but somehow it's an outrage to pass health care on that level. I think you're going to see some real pushback on that from Democrats.
You know, I agree with EJ. I don't think it's dead. I think it's a heavy lift, but I don't think it's dead. And I think what the president wants and what Democrats are trying to do is basically have a little cooling off period here. Let's pull back. He has said, let's let the dust settle. I think they're going to need to let the dust settle for a while to just get themselves back on track. He's hoping that House Democrats will kind of come to their senses and realize, hey, we already voted for this thing. Are we going to go into the midterm elections getting slammed for voting for it and then for not passing it? So I think they're just waiting for things to shake out before they try this kind of sidecar solution that EJ's talking about.
There was some talk this morning that indeed progressives will push for a coverall in the health care bill, that you will have a national program. Do you think that that's going to be in the House bill?
I don't think so. I do think the reason this is such a heavy lift is because not just in Massachusetts and not just the implied message of the New Jersey and the Virginia elections, but the polls have been terrible for health care ever since last summer. The reason they started going down was the Democrats introduced a bill. And once bills came out, the polls have been going down. The most recent, I'll just read, CNN asked a couple of days ago, what do you think Congress should do on health care? Pass a health care bill similar to the legislation that Congress has been working on for the past year, start work on an entirely new bill, or stop working on any bills that would change the country's health care system? The people who want to pass the bill that exists now, 30%. Start on a new bill, 48%. Stop working altogether, 21%. That's 69%, almost 70% of the people in the CNN poll say the Congress should throw out the bills that exist now and either start working on a new one or just stop working altogether. That is why Democrats are terrified, and they have good reason to be.
You know, just on that poll, when a poll gives people two ways of voting no and only one way of voting yes, it's easy to get a very big no.
Surely you're not suggesting that any of the polls have shown approval for the health care bills.
No, but I do think that the numbers are not as bad as those numbers might suggest. But
okay, well, let's say it's 55-40.
Let me accept your point for the sake of argument. I think there are two views out here. The Republicans believe that this bill is deeply unpopular, period. The Democrats believe that the Republicans have done a very good job of emphasizing things, in some cases like the death panels, that aren't even in the bill, and that the process that Congress has gone through has been extremely ugly, and that has tainted the bills. And what a lot of people who support health care reform are arguing is, look, the only way you'll ever have a fair test of whether the Republicans or Democrats are right are to pass a bill that people can actually start defending and say, but you're getting this and this and this out of the bill. Do you really want to repeal it? In this session, Pelosi said a funny thing. She said, you can't bake a pie and sell a pie at the same time. Now, in fact, good big baking companies probably can do both. But her point was, we got to get something out there and then we can start to sell it.
Also, Diane, you know, as a practical matter, there are some things in this bill that are very popular. It's popular to end the ban on pre-existing conditions. It's popular to end the practice of lifetime, putting lifetime caps on coverage. And those things are very popular, but what people don't realize and what Republicans and Democrats will have to come to grips with is that in order to get those things done, you have to expand coverage to everyone. Otherwise, the economics of health care don't work for the industry.
Cheryl K. Stolberg, she's a White House correspondent for The New York Times. We'll take a short break and be right back. And welcome back. It seems our guests all have something more to say about health care. Cheryl, you wanted to finish up.
I did. I think it's important to understand that while a lot of Democrats and Republicans think it would be very easy to pass the popular parts of this bill, it really has to be done in a comprehensive manner. In order for the economics of it to work and for premiums not to go sky high, everyone has to be covered. And the president kind of made that point last night and said, if anybody has a better idea about how to do this, come to me. Show me. And frankly, so far, nobody has come.
Yeah, I just didn't want to leave the impression that this sidecar strategy, which I do think is a good strategy and the only way to get this bill through, will be a piece of cake. I mean, the Democrats have that old problem of the commons, where I think the party as a whole has a huge interest in passing this. They're already stuck with all the negatives. And if they can't take all those negatives and then they pass nothing, they just look feckless. So I think a party has an interest in passing a bill. But individual members from difficult districts may say, yeah, it may be good for the party, but I want to go no on this. Now, in many of those cases, they already have a yes vote on the bill. And I think that's the bottom line, that there are so many Democrats with yes votes on health care. It's going to be held against them anyway. Might as well produce something for it.
And I do think the president mentioned and EJ mentioned the ugliness of the process. And I think the ugliness of the process reflects the underlying problems of the bill. They wouldn't have had to twist themselves into a pretzel if the bill were not objectionable to so many people. And so you can't really say, oh, the process was just so ugly, and suggest that the bill is actually good and popular, because if it were good and popular and had greater support, they would not have had to go through the process.
No, if we didn't have this stupid rule that every bill needs 60 votes in the Senate, we wouldn't have had this process. And any bill on health care is going to be deeply controversial because it affects such a big part of the economy.
All right. I do realize that health care is very
We're taking
important.
Over.
Yeah, right. And I'm not going to let you do that either. Let's talk about Wall Street regulation, Cheryl. What did the president have to say?
Well, the president had to say that he's proposing financial reform. He wants these tough new restrictions on banks, and he's sticking with it. And he also kind of backed away from some of that populist rhetoric that we've been seeing. He didn't come out swinging against Wall Street bankers for excessive bonuses and lining their pockets. He just said, look, I'm not interested in punishing banks. I want to protect our economy. We need to have strong, healthy financial markets. I'm trying to lay the groundwork for an economy where we won't get ourselves into the situation that that we saw when banks needed government bailouts.
Byron.
Well, it was like, I'm going to get tough on banks, and by the way, I want them to lend more. So I think that is a problem with the president. The other thing that's going to be a problem with the Republicans is when he said he was proposing to take $30 billion of the money that Wall Street had paid back from the bailout money and then use it to help community banks. I mean, the Republicans had viewed these bailouts as money that would return to the Treasury and be used to pay down the debt once it was actually repaid by the banks. The bigger problem, again, for Republicans is that some of the institutions the president is going after are institutions that took huge amounts in bailout money, but they paid it back with interest. Other institutions like General Motors, Chrysler, Fannie Mae, and Freddie still owe the Treasury billions of dollars, and the president's not proposing to crack down on them.
The president's bank fee to get money back into the Treasury is very popular. A lot of Republican pollsters are very worried about this issue because the voters really do want the banks to pay into a fund so that they're not stuck with a bailout. I thought he was doing a very interesting thing last night. He was essentially trying to split Wall Street from Main Street business. And he said some at the end of the speech, Cheryl's right, in the early part he didn't hit bankers, but he did raise some moral questions about the behavior of Wall Street at the very end of the speech. And yet he said all these wonderful things about smaller businesses, their importance in hiring people. And so I think splitting Wall Street from Main Street business folks is a potentially promising strategy for him. Main Street business will still be more Republican than not. But he doesn't want to. Nobody wants to be against the entrepreneur out there creating jobs. And he made sure he doesn't want to be that person either.
Yeah. You know, I think EJ's hit on really a new theme of this presidency. The president has got this Wall Street to Main Street tour going. He started in December. He went from not Wall Street, White House to Main Street. Sorry. But
see, that was his problem.
That was a Freudian slip. But in a way, it's his pivot. This is the pivot. It's to say, I'm focused on Main Street. He went to Allentown, Pennsylvania in December. He was in Elyria, Ohio last week, talking about small businesses, talking about the middle class. And we saw that in this speech last night, a lot of emphasis on tax credits, on things that Republicans can appreciate, a reduction in the capital gains tax, and also on that $30 billion that Byron talked about was, yes, to give it to community banks, but to give it to them so that they can lend it to small businesses.
CBS polls this morning indicate that the president did manage to connect more with the population than he had previously.
I think that's right. No, I think, look, this president is a good communicator, right? This was an unfiltered platform for him, the best TV a president can get, and free, by the way. So I think that he came across as likable and personable, and most important for him, he put his policies in the context of a narrative, a story that the American people can understand. I'm with you. I'm for jobs. My number one focus is on the economy. Yes, I want to fight for health care and financial services reform and all these things that are controversial. But he wove those threads into a broader narrative about the economy.
What about the question of earmark reform, Byron? How important was that?
In the president's speech, I think it got one sentence, didn't it? He said, I'm going to continue.
But it got a lot of applause from both
sides.
It got
a lot of applause. Let me see.
Including from lots of people who get earmarks all the time.
Okay.
It should be noticed.
You know, it's something when you call on Congress to change its internal practices, a president only has limited chances of success.
Okay. He said, for example, some members of Congress post some earmarks requests online. Tonight, I'm calling on Congress to publish all earmark requests on a single website before there's a vote so the American people can see how their money is being spent. EJ.
Mostly, I think this is a purely symbolic issue. I have, the problem with earmarks is they came to be abused. And I don't mean this as a partisan point. It's just historically the case that when the Republicans took over Congress, they started really using earmarks even more than Democrats did. I think within a limited framework, there's nothing wrong with a member of Congress trying to get money for a local swimming pool or a park or a school. But they've acquired all this symbolic meaning because they've come to be associated with wasteful spending. And some of the projects look silly. Maybe even some of the projects are silly.
So
it's good to I'm all for transparency. Nothing wrong with this. But I think it's largely symbolic.
But transparency is a problematic argument for the president to make after the stimulus and after some of the rush on the health care bills where bills were finished at the very last minute. And were not put on the internet, as the president said they would be for a period of time so the public could inspect them, and the like. Transparency is a real mixed bag for this president.
It was interesting to me that the president talked about last week's Supreme Court campaign finance decision, and he said last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law to open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections. And this morning there's a report, if you were watching closely, Justice Samuel Alito mouthed the words, not true. Cheryl.
A fascinating moment, I thought, a fascinating break in decorum, really, where you had a president taking on the other institutions of government. He took on Congress, but he also took on the Supreme Court directly with the justices sitting there before him. And to see that, to see Justice Alito shaking his head and mouthing the words, not true. Of course, nobody during this speech jumped up and said, you lie. But it was the silent you lie.
You're saying it was the equivalent
it was a very striking moment, I thought, to see the justice shaking his head no.
There was also the substance of it too, and I believe that Justice Alito probably had a point here. I think Linda Greenhouse, former longtime Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, said the president's words were imprecise. Certainly some conservatives have said he was just flat out wrong in the way he characterized it. So not only was it taking on the Supreme Court, which I agree was striking in a face-to-face way because there were six justices there. Three of them had been in the majority in the Citizens United case. But it was also they actually had a disagreement with what he said.
First of all, it shows how deeply politicized this decision was by the court. Just on the facts, the president's reference was to the Tillman Act passed in 1907, which was the original ban on corporate contributions to campaigns. The decision overturned precedents going back to the Austin case, which is about 20 years old, and also Buckley v. Valeo, which went back to 1976. So the specific legal precedents were longstanding but not 100 years old. But the general practice is saying, wait a minute, we want to limit corporate power in politics did go back 100 years. I think this issue has the potential of being a very, very big issue this year because the Supreme Court legislated from the bench on this. They overturned laws that Congress had passed and said corporations can do what they want in politics. They can't give money to campaigns, but if you vote against them, they can spend $1 million against you to defeat you. And I think there's going to be a big fight around this issue. And it's going to raise the whole question of whether judicial activism is now not a habit of the left anymore. It's a habit of the right.
And it's a reminder of the importance of the president's job in nominating Supreme Court justices. And we are getting indications that that Justice Stevens might retire this year, in which case we would have another battle over the direction of the court. And I think that this could be an issue in 2012, again, if the court continues with these kinds of sort of expansive rulings or rulings that kind of shake up the public.
One thing about which the American public is most concerned is the creation of jobs. The president talked about that last night without specifics, Byron.
There were not many specifics. We know that the Democrats are working on a jobs bill. Republicans call it a second stimulus.
What's in it?
It'll be more money for public works programs. It will be tax cuts for small businesses to create jobs, to reward
and
small businesses for creating jobs.
And the Republicans like that part.
They do.
It.
You know, there was an interesting op-ed in the New York Times by Orrin Hatch and Charles Schumer, a Republican.
Long-time allies.
Republican
I was
and Democrat.
When I saw that.
About a way to reduce the payroll tax for companies that hire unemployed people in a way that the company begins to benefit right now and not on its 2011 taxes. So there are ways, I think, that you'll see some bipartisan action on this.
Orrin Hatch used to team up with Ted Kennedy on a lot of things.
That's right.
So maybe his new partner is Chuck Schumer. I mean, the Democrats' problem is the election is in November. It's very hard to take federal action now that's going to produce a whole lot of jobs between now and November. And that, you know, I'm one of those who thinks the original stimulus should have been bigger. But they can do some things. I think aid to states is probably the most important thing they could do.
E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What about transportation and the lack of focus on this East Coast corridor?
Well, the president and the vice president together are in Florida today talking about money for stimulus money for rail projects down there. And interesting to see the two of them together. You know, Joe Biden is the biggest fan of
train
Amtrak.
Rider.
Well, he rode Amtrak every single night home from Washington to Delaware when he was a senator. He's probably their single biggest customer. So no wonder Barack Obama brought him along.
By the way, I said aid to states. I should have said aid to states and local governments because that's important. The thing with the state
Which
of the
union is a huge part of the original stimulus. That's where the money went out first from the stimulus.
Right, although it was cut back and we've had a lot of layoffs still. I mean, states have to behave in a completely counter-cyclical way. When you want government spending money, they either have to raise taxes or lay people off or both, and that's not good for growing the economy. The thing with the State of the Union speech is you cannot get immense detail on much of anything except a small number of things like health care or jobs that the president wants to mention. I'd love to have a big debate on high-speed rail, and there are counter views of it. I think there are within the country probably 10 or 12 corridors where it could actually work and would be very good for energy conservation over the long haul.
All right. We're going to open the phones now. We'll go first to Medford, Oregon. Good morning, Barbara. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning from the state who just voted to increase the taxes on the wealthy and corporations. I want to say that I believe the Democratic Party is the party of the people. I voted for Barack Obama to change the status quo, and I think it's very hypocritical of Republicans to adopt their mission statement to see this president fail. And that's my comment.
All right. Thanks for calling. Byron.
Well, there were substantial differences between what the Republicans wanted to do and the Democrats wanted to do. And the Republicans, no doubt, when they saw the cap-and-trade proposal, when they saw the health care proposal that came out of the Democratic bill-writing process, they voted against them. They didn't want to see those things become law. What's wrong with that?
Is last night's speech likely to change the behavior between Democrats and Republicans? Cheryl. Or is the Republican Party going to continue to just say no?
I think that's to be determined, and I'll tell you why. With the loss of the 60-vote supermajority in the Senate, Republicans do have to take some kind of ownership. They will have to go into the elections, the midterm elections, with some kind of agenda or platform other than just stopping what the president was doing. And so the president was right when he said, you've got to to govern too. He threw out an olive branch last night. He said, "I want to meet monthly with the Republican leaders."
And there was a little ripple of laughter.
And he was very attuned to it. And he sort of leaned back and cocked his head and he said, "I know you can't wait." But it was an extension of a hand. And I also would like to draw your attention to a very interesting poll, the Wall Street Journal, NBC, that says the public is fed up with Washington, but not necessarily with the president. Only 27% said they blamed the president for not being able to find solutions to the country's problems. 48% blamed Republicans in Congress. Nearly as many, 41%, blamed congressional Democrats.
That caller, I think, was an interesting a piece of evidence that maybe the president started to do one of the things he needs to do. Democrats have been in trouble because they are losing support in the center among independents, but their own base has been demobilized and discouraged. And the fact that now she was probably a good citizen and would have called you anyway, but the fact she picked up the phone and said, "Yeah, look at what these Republicans are doing to Barack Obama and to the Democrats." And I think this campaign against Just Say No is partly designed to motivate Democrats who had been discouraged.
Two words, Byron.
Well, we should remember and talk about how much Democrats opposed this spending fee, this spending freeze idea when it was thrown out.
All right, and we'll talk about that when we come back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By Jonathan Cutchins, recognizing NPR's coverage of educational issues across the United States. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The bond between humans and animals and its importance to our evolution. An anthropologist explains our obsession with pets and the various roles animals have played through time. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Bill Ryerson in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He says, "Do today's guests have any sense how many Republicans in the House and Senate are open to working with the president and the Democrats, but are prevented from doing so by Republican leadership?" Cheryl.
Well, I think Republicans are signaling that they're open to working with him on the issues that they can find agreement on. And in fact, there are some issues that the president laid out last night where they do find agreement.
Such as,
well, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, was on the floor this morning saying we can work with him on certain issues, such as the free trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama. The president called for ratifying those agreements. They were proposed by under George Bush's administration, and they were stalled by Democrats. Barack Obama says he wants to get them done.
But there are an awful lot of people in the country who are worried about more free trade.
Well, free trade is a complicated issue for Democrats, and there are people who are worried about it. Obama has pretty much come out and said, you know, we can't shut our borders. We have to understand that we exist in a global economy. I've heard him say that very recently, frankly, in hard-hit areas, areas that are losing manufacturing jobs.
It shows what a good politician McConnell is, that he would love to have the Democrats tear each other apart over a trade agreement. So he brought that. He brought that up just on the question of working with the Democrats. Somebody in the White House yesterday was telling the story early in the health care fight of a Republican senator who put a whole bunch of ideas on the table talking to President Obama. And Obama said, yeah, those are all good ideas. We can include all those in the health bill. Will you be able to vote for it? And he said, probably not. So I think there is a lot of pressure in the Republican caucus to continue with an oppositional stance on those kinds of issues that are seen as fundamentally Democratic
issues.
Here's
a message from Facebook. Joe says, please ask your panel what they make of the political nature of Samuel Alito during the speech. Does that further undermine faith in the supposed objectivity of the court? Byron.
I thought it was an unusual moment. It didn't strike me as overly political. I think that, Alito felt that the president had strongly, seriously mischaracterized the opinion, and the president had he's the one who kind of started this. He said this to them in front of them and didn't have to say it quite the way that he did. So, that he was caught on camera mouthing this, and obviously he didn't say it in a way that seemed to be audible to, any microphones. I'm just not troubled by this.
Yes, I agree with Byron. I said before that it was a striking moment. But I think, look, Supreme Court justices write opinions, right? That's their whole job, is to have opinions and to write them. So the fact that he disagreed with the president wasn't surprising or a political statement, I don't think.
Some of us began losing faith in the Supreme Court with a certain decision called Bush v. Gore in 2000. All and right. I think this latest corporate decision will only take folks like me who feel that way and say this court has really been politicized by the conservatives.
And didn't Sandra Day O'Connor herself come out and make a statement about this decision?
She was very careful, but she was critical. And what she was worried about, interestingly, were judicial elections. In a lot of states, judges are elected and not appointed. And what corporations could do in those circumstances. Now, a few states already allow corporate contributions, that should be said, but she's worried about what impact this would have on judicial elections. And I think she's right about that.
All right. To Ron in Traverse City, Michigan, good morning to you.
Yes, good morning, Diane, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
I heard President Obama last night say he would like to double our exports. And I wonder if he's referring to our number one export. Would he like to double that?
You're talking about military weapons.
I am.
All right, EJ.
He didn't distinguish what kind of exports, so it wouldn't shock me. But I think what he had in mind were other kinds of exports.
All right. Here's another message from Facebook. D says, I'm afraid President Obama's plea for unity has fallen on deaf ears, particularly after I heard the Republican response. I'm old enough to remember the Carter presidency and feel that, again, Republicans and the inner Beltway crowd are rallying round to freeze out an outsider.
Well, in the Carter years, I believe that was the last time before this last session that Democrats had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. But I'll ask again, what is so important about unity right now? I mean, there's a very big bill on the table. There is significant disagreement about it. The public seems to be, concerning these bills that are under consideration, solidly opposed to it. And so what is wrong with Republicans opposing it? It seems to me that you've got a situation where the majority party, the Democrats, are supporting a minority position, which is support for the current bills, and the minority party, the Republicans, are supporting a majority public opinion, which is opposition to the bills.
Cheryl?
I guess I think that everybody ought to take a deep breath and remember that Democrats still have 59 votes in the Senate. they have a sizable majority. And the president's message was directed to them last night as well. But I think, look, they've got this majority, but they can't do it on their own. They've got to reach across the aisle or find a way to find some kind of consensus. I think often actually of Ted Kennedy, who probably, had he been here, would have found some way, I would like to think, of bringing some Republicans on board on this effort.
And speaking of Ted Kennedy, here's an email from Kathy. She says, since when does Massachusetts speak for the rest of the country? At any other time, Republicans would be saying how out of touch Massachusetts is with the views of people in other areas of the country. The media has taken one out-of-cycle election in one state, in one section of the country, and decided that this is a nationwide trend. Stop over-dramatizing the situation and use some common sense.
Well, as a Massachusetts native, I want to start talking about President McGovern, where the one state he carried other than the District of Columbia, which is not, alas, a state yet. I think there are two things here. On the one hand, sure, this person is right. A single election should not be treated as if it were a midterm election that transferred power. And as Cheryl said, 59-41 is a big majority in any other rational universe except the United States Senate, which I think is not a fully rational universe. On the other hand, when you take a hit in Massachusetts and you're the Democrats, that is a big hit. So, my hometown, Fall River, Massachusetts, voted, I believe, 74% for Barack Obama. Martha Coakley, the Democrat, got 57% in the last election. It is a warning sign to Democrats, and it's a helpful warning sign because it came a long time before the midterm elections, and they can now get ready. And I think Obama's speech yesterday was the first step in trying to do
that. So how do you think that Scott Brown's win affects President Obama's agenda, if at all?
Well, I think it underscored a couple of things. One is all those independent voters who defected, and particularly working class voters, white voters who didn't go to college. The defection rate seemed especially high in those groups. Those are the groups who are being hit especially hard by this economy. And it said he's got a lot of work to do to bring some of them home.
It's all about context. This Massachusetts race happened after the Virginia and the New Jersey races. And in terms of health care, it happened in the context of solid public opinion polling showing opposition to the bill. So what happened was you had this large structure, this health care and Democratic support for it, which was very weak inside. This election happened, and I agree with EJ, everybody thought, my goodness, it happens in Massachusetts. What's going on here? It sort of it underscored, or it revealed, the inner weaknesses of this whole thing, and people began running away from it in droves.
I also think it was a reminder to the public, and maybe more important to the president, of the things that he promised to do that he hasn't done. He came in and he said he was going to work in a bipartisan way. And he came in and he said, I'm going to end the backroom dealing, the special interest, you know, horse trading that goes on. And frankly, the health care bill demonstrated on both fronts that he has not achieved that.
Okay. So here's my question, going back to the way EJ started. He said, President Obama calmed the Democrats. He made a strong statement on health care. He said that Democrats will pay, or Republicans will pay the price for being obstructionists, and he seemed more likable. But the question is, did he connect with the people? Did he make that strong connection to the people who are out of work, who are losing their homes? Did his message get to them? Cheryl?
You know, I hate to duck the question, Diane, but it's only the morning after the speech.
So you don't
I think
know.
It's just too soon to tell. We need to give it at least a day or a couple of days to get the sense of how Republicans and Democrats on the Hill are reacting. How are people reacting?
At this point, we're all the prisoner of our own personal reaction.
But you know what? I'm getting tired of waiting to hear how the people on the Hill are reacting. I'm more interested in how the people who are listening to this program are reacting, because it's their jobs, it's their insurance, it's their house that's on the line.
By the way, just on the Massachusetts thing, in fairness to the Republicans, if Democrats had won a special election in Mississippi, they'd be talking about it a lot. No, I think your point is well taken.
There would be a lot of looking in the mirror.
Yes, on happened. The I think we can guess that he connected. He began to reconnect with the Democratic base. I think independents heard a lot of what he was talking about in terms of the failures of Washington. Note, he did not say it's failures of Democrats. It's this mess in Washington. Ronald Reagan did a great job being in Washington, running against Washington. Why not Barack Obama? In terms of the unemployed, the one moment that I thought might have been very effective is when he was talking about all the trouble he had and all the attacks. And then he said, but, you know, compared to what people are going through out there, this is nothing. But I think this is only a first step to try to reconnect with those voters. He's got a lot of work to do.
Let's go to Jeff in Alstead, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
And guests. The president, in his address last night, said that he hope to pass a plan that would save $1 trillion. And it's doubtful. It looks like that's going to happen. But it seems to me that would be a possibility if the United States were to adopt a universal health coverage plan similar to those in place in so many Asian and Western democracies. I've got a chart in front of me here in the National Geographic this month, not a left-wing rag. It's based upon data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and it shows the United States at the very top in terms of cost, $7,290 per person per year, and a whole raft of European. Switzerland is the next highest at $4,417. Portugal's down at $2,150. There's a whole raft of countries in between, and they all have higher life expectancies than the United States. Now, and they all have a universal health coverage. It's either private, non-profit insurance companies, or it's public single payer. It's in a wide variety of plans. And I understand that this is a total political non-starter in our country. And I'm wondering if your guests could comment on what it says about our legislative process, that this apparently very effective approach can't even be discussed in this country, does it?
Jeff, thanks for your call, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Cheryl.
The caller is absolutely right. It is a political non-starter in this country for a variety of reasons. It would basically wipe out the insurance industry. That's a big money industry. We know they pour a lot into political campaigns. The president himself took it off the table very early in the debate. You know, what does it say about this country? It says that Americans are maybe willing for change, but not such big change.
You know, it's all based an enormous amount of this is based on opposition to the mandate, because you can't have none of this works unless there is a law requiring everybody to have a policy. Recent poll in Nevada, where Harry Reid is in big trouble, showed opposition to the health care bill, showed that 1 in 5, 20% of the people said they would pay a fine rather than meet the mandate that they have to have. That there's this visceral American opposition to this. And the caller may be right about European countries and other places, but there seems to be a visceral American rejection of this.
The call is right in the sense that if everybody is in a system in the long run, that'll keep costs down. Whether that system is a single-payer system or a system that involves subsidized private insurance is another question. The Netherlands and Switzerland have good systems that are based on universal coverage done through regulated insurance companies. Political scientists have this idea of path dependency. Where you start helps determine where you end up. We had near universal coverage through both the trade union movement and private employers. It makes it very hard for us in one step to move to single payer. This bill would get us much closer to universal coverage.
Was anybody surprised that the president left the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, truly sort of at the end, the very end, Iran, North Korea? What about that?
I was surprised. A 71-minute speech, 9 minutes devoted to foreign policy. This is a president who is prosecuting two wars, who just lived through an aborted Christmas Day attack, a terrorist attack that could have really upended his presidency a lot more than this Massachusetts election did. And scant attention to this, a reflection, I think, that this is simply not on the minds of Americans the way it once was. This country is focused on jobs, 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 and that's where the president had his emphasis last night.
Well, it's not on Obama's mind right now. I agree with this, the 9 minutes part. But clearly, the president, I think, misread public opinion about the Christmas Day bombing. I think there was much more concern about it than the president conveyed in his initial response to it. His description of the war in Iraq, he said, "We are responsibly leaving Iraq to its people. We're out of there." It was a very businesslike description of this war.
For the reasons Cheryl described, I wasn't at all surprised that there were only 9 minutes there. The country's mind is at home right now. And the problems the president has to deal with right now are at home. Therefore, that was
other
where his
terrorism.
Speech was. Other than terrorism. And you're right. In the first moments of that first day, he had a problem. He corrected pretty fast. He realized he had to worry about the reaction to terrorism.
E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times. Lots more to talk about. Could have gone on for another hour. Next time, maybe we will. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.